You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Today's podcast features the IEA's Head of Education, Dr. Steve Davies, being interviewed by Digital Officer Madeline Grant about how we devise maps, and therefore look at the world, in an entirely wrong way. Steve proposes a radical overhaul of the way we compile maps, arguing that a focus on cities and city regions, as well as indicators such as connectivity, are a far more productive method of mapping than relying solely on traditional indicators like national borders. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out our website, iea.org.uk, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, username IEA London.
One of the greatest of all human discoveries is the map. The map enables us to make sense of the world and in a way to control the world in a way that's not possible without it. So it's a hugely important human discovery. Cartography is one of the great human sciences. However, maps not only enable us to control the world, in many ways they also control us and the way we think about the world. The map that we have of the world gives us an impression of what it's like, which can often be deeply misleading. The famous example is the Mercator projection, which leads us to seriously overestimate the size of lands near to the Arctic Circle compared to lands near to the equator. So most people have no idea of just how enormous Africa is, for example. They do not realise that you could tuck the whole of India and the whole of the United States into Africa and still have plenty of room left over. The problem for map makers, of course, is that it's impossible to get an accurate reproduction of a spherical surface like the Earth's surface on a plane surface, a map. So you have to sacrifice accuracy somewhere. The Mercator projection worked mainly because, for reasons to do with the distribution of water on the planet's surface, it is pretty good for navigating across seas. It has the relative distances correct when you're on the ocean. And so since maps were originally drawn up for sailors, that's why we still use it. But we should definitely move on. But what I would want to talk about here is a different kind of map. That's to say, a political map and an economic map. Because if you look at political maps of the world, or if you look at maps which try to explain how the world economy is working, they typically show the world as divided up into sovereign territorial states, which are shown as discrete blocks of colour. And so this is linked to the way in which we talk about the French economy, the German economy, the American economy. In other words, we think of the world economically, socially, culturally, as well as politically, as being divided up into discrete blocks of land, which are dominated and ruled over by single sovereign governments, nation governments. Now, actually, if you're wanting to plan logistics, do a marketing campaign, understand how the economy works, or how society works, that's a completely wrong map. You should tear up that map and get another one. If you want, for example, to understand what is going on in American society, politics, commerce, business now, the map you need to use is the one produced by the Department of the Interior, which is called the Metropolitan Statistical Area Map. And this shows the United States divided up not into 50 states, with many of them with suspiciously straight edges, but rather into about 400 metropolitan areas, which range in size from Greater New York or Greater Los Angeles, which have something like 20 million inhabitants, to much smaller areas like Bismarck, North Dakota, which has a population of about, I think, 30,000 or something like that. But what is a metropolitan area? Well, a metropolitan area is essentially an urban core, a fairly substantial town or city, surrounded by smaller towns and ultimately a semi-rural periphery, which, however, is economically connected to and linked to the core. So in the United Kingdom context, for example, examples of metropolitan areas would be Greater Manchester, Merseyside, West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire, the so-called Sheffield City region, which includes big chunks of Derbyshire and Nottinghamshire, the East Midlands region, which is basically Derby, Nottingham, Leicester, but not rural Leicestershire. London, of course, Bristol. In Scotland, Greater Glasgow or Edinburgh. So that's what metropolitan areas are. They're city regions of that kind. Now, if you want to understand what's going on in the world economy, these are the basic units. This is where things happen. And also, if you look at the world and you look at things like connections via air transport or movements of goods, movements of capital, movements of people, shipping movements, you realise that the world actually consists of about between 1,000 and 2,000 city regions that are linked together by all these connections of one kind or another. And you can establish how highly connected a city is by looking at things like how many places you can fly to directly or with no more than one change from its airport. So, for example, in the case of London or New York or Chicago or Paris, you can fly to pretty much anywhere on the planet with no more than one change. There are plenty of other cities, however, where that's not true for most of the world. You need to make two or three changes to get to many places. And similarly, if you look at things like the flow of people or capital, you'll find that some cities are much more connected to the rest of the world than others. So Manchester, for example, and London are much more connected to the rest of the world through immigration links and business flows than, for example, Greater Glasgow or Liverpool are. And this is very striking when you look at it in that way. And that explains, amongst other things, why Manchester and London are successful, very successful in London's case. Pretty successful in Manchester's, whereas Liverpool and Glasgow, nothing like as successful economically. And so you don't want a map of the world which shows it in discrete blocks like that. What you actually want is a map of the world, which shows you little nodes everywhere. And the nodes are cities which are then connected and linked together. And that's more a map of how the world goes. And when you do this, you realise that New York is probably more connected to Europe and parts of Latin America than it is to, say, the middle of the United States. Similarly, Dallas or Houston is as closely connected to, say, South America as they are to the northeast of the United States. And you begin to realise that the political divisions and the political boundaries that we see in the world now do not accurately reflect the real social, human, economic connections between different parts of the world that actually exist in reality. And you can see this starting to have an effect at the political level, where increasingly it's the metro region that is the effective level of politics where things actually get done and get done effectively. And you can see a move towards this in the UK, where George Osborne started this project of handing over significant amounts of decision-making power to metropolitan mayors, initially in Manchester, where he was a local MP, of course, and subsequently to other areas. A policy that's continued at the moment, but also in the United States, in Italy, and above all in China, where the entire system of local government has been completely transformed compared to what it has been for all of Chinese history, into one where the country is basically divided up into about 460 what are called prefecture-level cities, city regions, in other words.
Fascinating. My first question is why it is that I don't necessarily disagree with this model of viewing the world, but why is it that across the world the city region has been heightened in such importance when there are still huge numbers of countries that are largely agricultural and their economies are still based around that agrarian setting? And then, for example, if you look at Britain, perhaps the biggest divide is still between town and country. They vote differently. Yeah. They work in different sectors. And looking at an electoral map, you see that the rural vote is largely conservative and the Labour vote is entirely associated with urban centres. So does it make sense to combine city and country in this way?
Well, the model I'm describing actually doesn't combine city and country. If you look at the map of the United States I mentioned, you'll notice that there are large areas that are white on the map. These are the bits in between the metropolitan regions I spoke about, metropolitan areas. Now, you could unkindly describe these parts of the United States as what is known as Mamba country. That's an acronym and stands for miles and miles of bugger all. But actually, that's both unkind and misleading, because although they're thinly populated, cumulatively, those parts of the United States, places like Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, most of Nebraska outside Omaha, that kind of place, they actually contain about a quarter to a third of the United States population. So although they're very thinly spread out, that's still a lot of people. Similarly, in the UK, sure, there are these big cities, London, Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester and so on, but there's also huge rural areas in the West and East Midlands, Lincolnshire, for example, rural Leicestershire, most of Staffordshire, the Welsh borders, the whole of rural North Yorkshire, which are more thinly populated, but which still, in total, contain a very large number of people. And one of the big challenges is precisely how to what to do with these in-between areas. And as you rightly say, one of the most profound and basic splits in politics in many parts of the world now is between the city and the countryside. And this is playing out in different ways in all kinds of countries. It's a big split in India, for example, where, paradoxically, it's the Congress party, the more left-wing party, that tends to do better in the rural areas, and the BJP, the so-called right-wing, the Hindu Nationalist Party, that's doing much better in many of the urban areas. Venezuela, Chavez, until recently, or Maduro now, got most of his support, the really strong support, from the rural parts of Venezuela. And the two big urban areas, Maracaibo and Caracas, were strongholds, particularly Maracaibo, were strongholds of the opposition. So this division is recurring over and over again. We can see it in the United States with Donald Trump. We can see it in France with Marine Le Pen, or in the UK with Brexit. It's worth saying that the split is not just, though, between town and country. It's rather between, on the one side, successful metropolitan areas like London, and on the other side, both the countryside and unsuccessful city regions. Places like, for example, Tyne and Wear or Teesside. In the United States, Donald Trump didn't just do very well in the rural areas, he also did very well in places like Youngstown, Ohio, or Scranton-Wilkes-Barre, which are semi-derelict, very run-down ex-industrial parts of Ohio and Pennsylvania, respectively. Whereas he did very badly in the successful metropolitan areas like Greater Boston, New York, Chicago, Southern California. So that's where the big division is, and that's quite a challenge, because there's a fundamental division of interest between those two parts of the world. In some countries, like large parts of Africa, there are very successful, very dynamic city regions, like Nairobi, for example, Lagos, Durban, Greater Johannesburg. But the majority of people in that continent are still living in the rural areas. But that's a function of the lack of urbanisation in sub-Saharan Africa. And I suspect that actually that is going to change in the next few decades.
Well, actually, going back to what you were saying about London's success, I've suddenly thought of another really good example of how misleading maps can be. If you take mapping the countries of Europe according to GDP, Britain does pretty well. It's ranking quite high up in that list. But actually, I saw another map recently that did the same calculation, taking out London and taking average without London, and it's extraordinary. London gives you a wildly inflated idea of how prosperous Britain is as a country. And also, within Europe, we have some of the poorest areas in Western Europe, at least, and areas of great deprivation, places like Glasgow and various places in the Welsh Valleys. And yes, of course, taking things as an average.
This is absolutely true. And it makes much more sense to look at things like the social problems and social success at the city region level. In Scotland, for example, if you look at that kind of GDP comparator you're talking about, Scotland appears to be doing pretty badly compared to the rest of the EU. However, when you disaggregate that, you discover that most of Scotland is doing okay. And two city regions, the Aberdeen city region and the Edinburgh one, the Forth side one, are doing really well. The problem is Greater Glasgow, which is a social catastrophe, quite frankly. It's one of the worst performing city regions in the whole of Europe by a whole number of measures, despite all their best efforts. Sociologists are still very interested in what they call the Glasgow effect, which is the fact that people die much younger in Glasgow, even controlling for diet and poverty and all the rest of it, than they should do. And the same is true in other countries. So if you look at Spain, for example, a large part of Spain's GDP comes from Greater Barcelona, Greater Madrid and Valencia. If you take them out, a lot of the rest of Spain is barely doing anything. And the same is true in France. There are about 16 metropolitan areas, not just Paris, but a whole lot of other ones, Lyon, Bordeaux, Marseille, Aix-en-Provence, a couple of others, Lille, which are doing very, very well. And then there's rural France and small towns, very often old ones, Angers or Troyes, for example, which are semi-derelict and in really, really bad shape. So, yes, disaggregating these national statistics gives you a much more accurate picture of what is actually going on.
And that's why it's very good, actually, that policymakers in recent years have started to use the GVA, the gross value added metric, to define areas of the country by productivity.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also the governments around the EU and policymakers are tending to recognise that the city region is actually the important area. And this, as I mentioned, in the UK, but also in Italy and in Germany, increasingly, there's a move towards city regions as the basic units. Similarly, in the Netherlands, where what they call the Randstad, which is basically Rotterdam, Amsterdam, The Hague, is being increasingly recognised as a unit, which creates about 60% of the Netherlands GDP, among other things. The problem is, I think, what on earth do you do with the bits that you can't fit into the city regions? This is the big challenge, I think, for the public policymakers.
But no map is perfect. I mean, to create the perfect map, it would have to be exactly the same size as the world that we're currently inhabiting. So.
Yes, exactly. We should make it useless. This is absolutely true. The point, that is precisely the point about maps. Maps, by definition, cannot have a one-to-one correspondence with the thing they're describing and be useful. And therefore, you have to select the thing that you want to use or find useful. So the Mercator projection selects distances that it takes to navigate long routes at sea, because that's what
it's historically been useful. The issue with the Mercator map is the fact that it adorns every classroom in Britain, and it therefore does have a tendency to exaggerate the northern hemispheres in terms in our consciousness.
Yes, and the size of places like Britain. Yeah. We don't realise how small Britain actually is. This is why people travel to the United States and then don't realise that Britain is the size of, well, it's smaller than the state of Alabama. So they do not realise just how big the United States actually is. Until they actually get there, and then they're quite horrified to discover that.
The other question I have is that, again, I've said I don't dispute the model of map that you're proposing, but I still think that we do live in a world where, for better or worse, and I think you and I would rather that nationality were less important. Things like nationality and religion are incredibly important, and looking at relations between people according to the flow of trade perhaps misses really important divisions that exist. And religion being one in particular, particularly in the Middle East.
Well, religion is put religion aside for a moment. I'll come back to that in a second. In terms of ethnicity and nationality, actually, the evidence is pretty clear that large, successful city regions are successful in no small part precisely because they are multi-ethnic and multinational, and therefore have lots of different talents, lots of different skills, and also lots of links to different parts of the world. And they tend to handle and manage it better than nation states do, or failed city regions do. As far as religion goes, religion is in itself actually an example of a transnational community that doesn't obey national ties. We all know about the way in which Islam today is very much, once again, as it has been historically, a transnational movement which doesn't pay much attention to national borders in the eyes of its believers.
But the example of India and Pakistan shows that religion can create national borders.
Yes, that's the only case apart from Israel of a state founded on religious principles. I think that's actually revealing. And also, it's worth saying that in Pakistan, one of the problems with that country is precisely that. Although it purports to be a state with an Islamic identity, actually the provincial ethnic identities of Sindhi and Punjabi and Pashto and Baluchi as well, increasingly, are, if anything, more important and tend to lead to constant conflicts within the state. But the point I was going to make is that actually it's not just Islam that's transnational. The same is true in many ways of Christianity, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, or if you think of the role of the Catholic Church in South America. And I think that What all this adds up to is a world in which national states are increasingly finding that they're being bypassed, but they're still very powerful because they're still the institutions with the legitimacy and the power to do things like tax, raise money, fund armies and kill people that other people do not have. But what I think may well happen in many parts of the world is that the city-state will gradually emerge alongside continuing nation states as an important political unit, and that we're going to see the effective, even if not de jure, decline of territorial government and its replacement by what are essentially city states and links of city state, connections of city states.
So actually, I have heard quite a lot of noise in the last year or so about London being so diametrically opposed to the rest of the country in many ways, particularly in terms of politics. And there has actually been the idea floated that London could be its own country. In some ways, that would make a lot of sense according to the model that you're proposing.
It would, and particularly if you then, as I think you would have to have for a city-state to be successful, it would then have free trade. The point is, city-states, the basic fact about city-states is that they can't feed themselves, typically, and therefore they are they have to follow an open free trade policy. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to survive. And so it actually makes much more sense, anyway, for a city like London to separate itself away from a political unit which it's increasingly out of sympathy with. It's worth saying that the most successful economies in the world today are two city-state economies, Hong Kong and Singapore. And they present a model, particularly Singapore perhaps, that many other parts of the world might want to follow for policy making and locating yourself in a world economy. And the whole dynamics of being the government of a city-state are going to push you in a direction which liberals will find welcome, really, because you have to be open, you have to be welcoming to new ideas, new people, new money, new products, because otherwise you will shrivel on the vine and you'll just end up as a derelict place that nobody wants to go to.
We hear the phrase metropolitan all the time. It's become a byword for all kinds of things. But I think there is some truth to it, and I'm wondering if it might be more accurate to describe the world as divided between a kind of rural demos and a kind of global elite that probably have way more in common with each other than they do with their own rural inhabitants.
I think that's probably true. And I think it's also true that there are two kinds of city, basically. There are the globally connected cities, which are what people are referring to when they're talking about a metropolitan elite. Places like New York, London, Paris, New Delhi,
Shanghai,
Hong Kong, Tokyo, and on the Sydney. And on the other hand, there are cities that are still connected, but nothing like as much, which have a much stronger, more local identity. Places like Glasgow, Liverpool, Marseille, maybe in some ways. And these places are in tension with each other because the second category tend to be much less cosmopolitan in their outlook. Now, I think economic forces are driving them that way, but very often there's resistance to it. Meanwhile, in the case of the rural areas, many of the people who've gone to live there are people who precisely don't want to live in the kind of world that you see emerging in the big, successful, globally connected cities. They want to live in a world where people around them are much more like themselves. Now, you can do that in a big city, but what tends to happen is that you get small villages in which everyone is similar, but they're embedded in a much larger, more varied kind of social matrix.
So what kind of examples are we perhaps referring to? The kind of Islington dinner party set that is so often derided in the media?
Well, that's one of the examples. if you think of Los Angeles, for example, Los Angeles County, San Bernardino County, Orange County, one of the largest metropolitan areas in the world, you've got, on the one hand, a kind of elite who tend to hang out in West Hollywood and places like that, who are very similar to the, you know, Islington literati that you alluded to. But then also, if you go around LA, you will find there are certain areas. There's a whole area which is known officially as Little Saigon, for example. It's entirely Vietnamese. There are other areas which are entirely Mexican, yet other areas which are entirely East European or Chinese or African American, Compton, Watts. But each of these local monocultures, if you will, is embedded into a much larger unit. And not only that, but the people who live in these areas typically have to work and interact with all the other ethnic groups around them. Now, many people like this. This strikes them as an ideal combination of unity and diversity. But there are some people who don't like it. They would rather live in an area where they know that for 100 miles, pretty much everyone is like themselves.
Yes.
And the thing is, if you want that, then you're going to have to go and live in either a rural area or a very unsuccessful and semi-derelict industrial area that nobody wants to go and live in.
Would it be fair to describe the hipster as one such monoculture?
Yes, absolutely. They're one example of many. There are many of these new kinds of cultures appearing in big cities. Hipsters are one. Another one, which I'm personally very interested in, is something called retrofuturism. Steampunk and dieselpunk and all this kind of thing. And so you have all kinds of strange cultures arising in cities, many of which are formed by taking ideas, images, cultures from other parts of the world and combining them in novel ways, or taking ideas from the past and then reviving them, which is what steampunk does, of course.
Yeah.
So this is, however, only possible in the city, because the problem with living in the rural parts of the planet is that they're thinly populated, the population density is low, and therefore it's very costly in terms of time and effort to make contact with other people who share your interest, if your interest is different from that of your immediate neighbours. Whereas in the city, it's low cost because, you know, they're nearby. and it's easy to get hold of them. So all kinds of cultures, like the hipsters of Shoreditch.
And actually the hipsters of Shoreditch are a really good example of a sign of a very successful city, is one that has a lot of hipsters and a lot of artsy types.
Exactly. That's very much so. This is the idea originally developed by Richard Florida in his book, The Rise of the Creative Class. It's that successful cities have lots of what he calls the creative class, which means not only people like Silicon Valley types, tech entrepreneurs, technical visionaries, but also artists,
musicians,
people who have funky barbershops,
and beards,
all kinds of strange stuff like that. And the rest of us may make fun of these people and their rather strange ways of living, and the crazy sort of like interior decor ideas that they have. But actually, they are the people who are the source of a lot of new ideas, new products, new technologies, new techniques, and new ways of living. And the rest of us tend to follow them. They're the trendsetters.